Welcome to CL Talk, the leading podcast for the legal profession across Canada, brought to you by Canadian Lawyer Magazine. I'm Tim Wilber, the managing editor of Canadian Lawyer Magazine. Today, I'm speaking with the Chief Justice of Manitoba, Marianne Rivoulin. She was appointed a judge of the Family Division of the Court of Queen's Bench in Manitoba in 2005. In 2015, she took over as Associate Chief Justice of the Family Division of the Court of Queen's Bench of Manitoba. Between 2018 and 2023, she was a Justice of the Federal Court of Appeal in Ottawa, and then she was appointed Chief Justice of Manitoba on June 1st of last year, and sits on the Court of Appeal. Welcome, Chief Justice Rivoulin.
Thank you.
So first off, can you tell me a bit briefly about your career before you joined the bench?
So before I joined the bench, I was in private practice from my article. So I articled in 1989 in Manitoba, and I was in two large firms in Winnipeg, basically from 1989 up to and including 2003. And there I practiced. The first firm, I was practicing primarily family law litigation in both official languages. And then when I joined the second larger firm, I did civil litigation, everything essentially but family litigation. I did continue to represent some family clients who were French speaking, but otherwise devoted my practice to civil litigation, municipal law, things like that. And then in 2003, I joined the Federal Department of Justice in Winnipeg in the regional office, and I was the team leader for the Aboriginal Law Services Group, senior counsel and team leader with respect to the Indian Residential School litigation files that were before the court and that we were dealing with at the time. So that's kind of an overview of my experience as a lawyer before I joined the bench in 2005.
Great. And can you tell me how you made the transition to the judiciary? What prompted you, how that came about, and how you found the transition?
So I was at the, as I just mentioned, at the Department of Justice dealing with Indian Residential School files, and I was really enjoying my experience there. But I had been encouraged, I'll put it that way, by members of the Francophone community and also members of the bench to submit an application for the bench. So as a result of that, I did apply to become a judge. And yeah, so that's how the whole thing happened. It was primarily because I had done a lot of French litigation. And also because I guess some of the members of the bench knew who I was and thought I maybe had the qualities of a good judge. I did apply, and lo and behold, you know, I was appointed February 2nd of 2005 on the family division of the court, at the time the Court of Queen's Bench.
Great. And if you could tell me a bit about how you found the transition sort of day to day, whether it was there was a steep learning curve, and then eventually I think you took on leadership roles. You've had various leadership roles before your current role, so you can tell me how that you sort of moved into those roles.
Well, my transition from being a lawyer to being a judge, I mean, it was a learning curve in the sense that I was familiar obviously with family litigation because I had practiced family law in my career. But, you know, as a litigator, as a lawyer, you're representing one side of a file. You're representing one person in particular in family law. Whereas on the bench, I soon realized that I had to look at both sides of the coin, both, you know, both perspectives, and that I was the decision maker. And as a trial judge, I was the fact finder. And so suddenly your mind shifts. You have a change in your mindset, and your mind shifts to looking at what's fair and reasonable and appropriate in the circumstances. So it's a different approach to decision making and making sure that you hear both sides and before making decisions. So it definitely was a different approach. I had worked though as a deputy commissioner at the Residential Tenancies Commission. I was a deputy commissioner for 10 years. So I was a decision maker in that sense. So I was used to making decisions, But still, when you're up there on the bench, it's you recognize and realize that the importance of the role and the need to make sure that you're well prepared, and that the most important thing is that you listen to the parties before you make any judgment calls. So, and I think you asked about the leadership role. So yes, when I was on the Court of Queen's Bench Family Division, I acted as an associate chief for almost 3 years of the family division, and then was appointed the associate chief of the family division in 2015. So as an acting associate chief justice, there's definitely a leadership role involved there to admit, you know, to do the, not only the administration of the court, but also when colleagues come to you with questions or concerns or challenges and all of that kind of thing. So there was a leadership role there, but I would say that I had some experience in a leadership role when I was at the Department of Justice, because I was the senior counsel and team leader for the residential school file. So there was a group of, I think, about 10 lawyers that I would kind of oversee. So I had some experience before joining the bench. Yeah.
Great. And you've had quite a varying variety of experiences. You mentioned family law, residential schools, various roles in the judiciary. So how's your professional and maybe your personal experiences shaped your judicial philosophy since taking on your current role as Chief Justice?
One of the most important experiences I had was when I was a lawyer and joined the Department of Justice, because I didn't know, I hate to say, but it's true, I didn't know anything about the history of Indian residential schools at that time when I joined in 2004. So that's where I basically got to understand the history. And I was involved with doing a number of discoveries of survivors from a particular First Nation in Manitoba. So I got to meet a number of survivors who were claimants, who were litigants. And through their stories and then through all of the reading and understanding, it really shaped my understanding of what Aboriginal people in Manitoba certainly have gone through and what the generations, you know, have gone through, and to understand the effects of residential schools on the Aboriginal population of Manitoba. So that shaped my view going in. It gave me a lot of social context to understand why, you know, things were the way they were in certain respects. And also when I was on the Queen's Bench in the family division, along with family law, I did a lot of child protection work. And in the child protection area, I think at the time about 89% of the children in care were of Aboriginal descent. And again, that I understood why there were these kind of social issues, you know, child poverty and all these kind of issues that arose because of the history in large part of residential schools. So I think that informed my views and my, I don't know if it's philosophy, but my views are that social context is really important, and to understand where people come from is important. Of course, and as the fact finder, it informs you too. And then you apply the law, obviously, to the facts that you've found. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but that gives you a sense of kind of where I was coming from. And then the work I did as a volunteer in the French community as a French language minority also informed me when I joined the bench as to some of the challenges for French language minority rights. So I came in with that background as well. And then my other background is I grew up on a farm in rural Manitoba. So I was not, you know, a city kid by any stretch of the imagination. So even having that rural background experience, I think informed my views to a certain extent about different people you might encounter. And remaining curious and open-minded and open-hearted about, you know, the people who appeared in front of you. That's kind of, I think all of those things informed my approach when I was on, well, I'm still on the bench, but certainly when I was a trial judge.
Great. And I want to ask about different elements of the court. You haven't been Chief Justice for a long time. It's been, I guess, just over, almost a year.
Not quite a year yet. That's right.
Right. So did you come with the sort of list of priorities or things you wanted to work on? And we can get into sort of some of the details of some of those things and how far along maybe they've gone, or maybe you've built on things that your predecessor was doing.
Well, when I joined the Manitoba Court of Appeal, first off, I knew what it was to be an appellate judge because I had been on the Federal Court of Appeal for almost 5 years. And on the Federal Court of Appeal, you know, they're a traveling court. So you go to all the major centers and the areas of law are vast, you know, and I worked in both official languages. So I had the opportunity to do, I don't know, 25% to maybe a third at some times of the work I did was either bilingual or in French. So I felt like I had gained a lot of knowledge as to what a good appellate court judge should do and how to work and how to write. And I had excellent colleagues in the Federal Court of Appeal that I learned from. And so when you're surrounded by excellence, you kind of, you know, you learn a lot. But when I had this opportunity to come back to my home province, because obviously Manitoba is my home province, and when I was actually appointed, I recognized that I was joining a court. I'd never sat on the Manitoba Court of Appeal. So I was joining as a new chief. But I'd been on the trial court of the King's Bench for 13 years. So I knew the people on the Court of Appeal. Some of them I knew very well, some not as well, but I knew them, you know, I was aware of who they were. When I started with the Court of Appeal, there was already something in motion by my predecessor to modernize the court, to bring the court into the digital era. It was in the works, put it this way. And so by the time I started, right around May of 2023, this integrated case management system, Thomson Reuters was awarded the contract by the province of Manitoba to create a system, basically a case management system that was digital. And it was agreed that three courts would be transformed into a digital technology, but they would start with the Manitoba Court of Appeal. So I fully embraced that's the biggest project and my biggest goal is to make sure that we turn our still paper-based court into a modern electronic court. And one of the things I think that I hopefully am bringing to this transformation is I was already used to that because I worked in the Federal Court of Appeal and we were dealing with digital technology, electronic files, you know, Zoom hearings. I mean, I was very familiar and comfortable with those things. So when I joined, I was able to maybe tell my colleagues, oh yeah, no, this is going to be great. I mean, you know, just to kind of explain that this was a positive step for access to justice and for lawyers and because I already had some valuable experience working in these kinds of systems. So building on that, from my perspective right now, my biggest goal is to make sure that this transition happens in a way that's reasonable. And right now we're on track to having the court case management system be completely operational by, I'm going to say, September of 2025, so that lawyers and self-represented litigants can file electronically. The judges can work with electronic documents, you know, the public will have access to electronic registry, that kind of thing.
Great, great. And so that's in terms of how the cases are managed. What about virtual proceedings? I would imagine my impression is the Federal Court of Appeal, at least certain kinds of cases, it's a little bit easier to do things virtually because of the nature of the disputes. What's your view on how that fits in with now that, you know, the pandemic's behind us for a while now? What is there a place for virtual proceedings and which ones are best suited for that?
There's certainly a place for virtual proceedings. In fact, just yesterday I sat in the Court of Appeal here in Manitoba and there was a hybrid proceeding where one party was in court with his lawyer and the other party was attending virtually by audio and virtual video. What we use here in Manitoba is GoToWebinar. So it's a different platform from Zoom. I was very used to Zoom hearings because that's a platform we use in the Federal Court of Appeal. In terms of which, I think there's always going to be a need and a role for virtual hearings, whether they're hybrid or full on. I encourage that, and I think it's a way to have better access to the courts from litigants who may be, you know, not living in Winnipeg. some hearings may not be as appropriate depending on if it's a criminal matter and the accused person has to be in the courtroom, or there may be some hearings where it's not great. But generally speaking, I'm certainly open to it, and our rules provide for it and allow it. I know my colleagues are open to it as well. If the lawyers or the parties want to attend in that way, we make it happen. And it's and rightfully so. I mean, for some people, the cost of travel and other things are prohibitive, and it's, and for a short hearing, it may not be necessary. So we're, I think the virtual hearings are here to stay, and that's a good thing.
Great. And in terms of court backlogs and, you know, the efficiency of the court, where is Manitoba? What do you want to see happen? And how can improvements be made, you know, at different levels of either government or within the court?
Well, I'm only speaking on behalf of the Manitoba Court of Appeal. I won't speak on behalf of the King's Bench or the Provincial Court about backlogs and whatnot. We're in good shape in Manitoba in the Court of Appeal. Right now, a party or a lawyer wants to have a date for an appeal, we can offer a date within 3 to 4 months. If there's a real emergency, we can actually, you know, make it happen even sooner. 3 to 4 months is very reasonable. Some lawyers think that's too quick, you know, it's too fast. So perhaps because the volume of work is not as high as in other courts of appeal, and, you know, we're pretty efficient here, so there are no real backlogs or delays in the Manitoba Court of Appeal. I'm happy to report that a lot of that is because of my predecessor, Richard Chartier. He was very good at organizing the court so that decisions were rendered, you know, quickly, and also that files were moved in the system in a reasonable way. And that continues. And the staff here, we're a small court. There are only 8 full-time judges, and we currently have 4 supernumerary judges. And the staff is very small, but very collegial, very hardworking, very smart staff that understand how to move the files appropriately through the system. So, yeah, I'm lucky to be sitting on this court. I know how challenging it is, you know, for other courts of appeal in Ontario, Quebec, Alberta. I mean, the volume and the complexity is, it's very different from here. So, yes, I love being in the Manitoba Court of Appeal, put it that way.
Great. Well, it sounds like you're in a better situation than other courts across the country. But I know appeal courts are quite different than trial courts. But
yes.
But yeah. So I have a lot of questions. We have limited time. So I wanted to ask you just about your advice to lawyers. So you see a lot of lawyers in front of you. You have in your other positions as well, obviously. What do you advise lawyers about how best to, you know, effectively advocate for their case?
Well, so at an appeal level, it's all about the writing. First off, I mean, your factum has, the writing is important, clear, concise writing, not overstating, not having 15 grounds of appeal, maybe 3 at the most. So the writing is key. And then when there are oral submissions, which of course normally there are, being organized and prepared and not reading from your factum, but also, being respectful and not trying to be somebody you're not, like maintaining your personality within the oral advocacy. Those are some of the key things I would say. But as an appeal court, the writing, you know, we read everything very carefully. You come into court with an impression, obviously. I mean, we're reviewing, it's either an error of law or palpable or writing error or whatever. We're not the decision makers. The facts are what they are. You know, you're kind of stuck with what the facts are. You look at the law. So it's more about convincing the court that there's some kind of error. And that's where the writing comes in. And then the oral advocacy is how to, you know, persuade a judge to look at things a little bit more closely. So, yeah, those are some minor points, but that's, I think, what I would recommend.
Yeah. And you're in a leadership position as well as, you know, influential, given you're in the judiciary. In terms of the legal profession overall, there are lots of current issues that they're talking about, whether it's mental health, diversity, or reforming the legal education system. So that's a really broad list of topics. you don't have to go into all of them, but if you could sort of say one thing about how the legal profession is that you would want to fix or that you're noticing in your role that is deficient, where do you think the real reforms need to take place for the legal profession?
For the legal profession, I guess from my perspective, it's the mentorship role that is missing. It seems to me that there are a lot of either young lawyers or sole practitioners who are taking on files that may be, you know, maybe more than what they should be taking on, and my sense is there's a lack of mentorship opportunities for lawyers in situations where they're, you know, either on their own or they're very junior. So that's a big one from my perspective. We've got a lot of new lawyers coming from other countries also who are practicing law in Manitoba. And oftentimes it seems that their sole practitioners are in very small groups. And again, there's a mentorship role that I think is lacking. So, I mean, the mental health piece, I haven't seen lawyers who are suffering from mental health in the courtroom, certainly, but I'm obviously aware that mental health is a big issue for lawyers, like having been a lawyer myself, and for judges too. I mean, people struggle with the challenges sometimes that they face, either professional or personal, and not being afraid of seeking help and looking to get some resources to help with mental health issues, I think it's important. I know in Manitoba that's happening. There are a lot of programs through the Manitoba Bar Association and the Law Society where they offer education programs and other things with respect to mental health. And in the judiciary as well, the National Judicial Institute has certain programs to ensure that judges will continue to be resilient and survive. One of the programs is called Survive and Thrive, and that's in the National Judicial Institute. And I was one of the faculty members on the program. So mental health is a big one, but from lawyers' perspective, the mentorship piece, I think, is also very, very important.
And looking forward, because as we talked about, you haven't been in this role for a long time. what do you think the biggest challenges will be for you as Chief Justice in the next few years that you want to be able to tackle for the court?
So apart from hopefully getting this case management information system, this electronic filing system in place, it's going to be dealing with artificial intelligence. I have a feeling that's going to be a challenge for the judiciary, for the legal profession. How we're going to navigate that is because it's here and it's not going away. And it's quite, you know, it can either be used for good, but it can be used for purposes that are not great either. And so I think artificial intelligence and how the legal profession deals with that is going to be one of the bigger questions that we'll have to deal with as a judiciary, as a legal profession overall in the next 10 years.
And are there any plans at the court to put out anything, any guidelines or anything for lawyers at this point for using that kind of technology?
The Court of King's Bench sent out a practice direction, I think probably over a year ago. I can't call exactly the date. And the Canadian Judicial Council is working on directions as well. So yes, there's things in the works. And at this point, our court hasn't done that. But when we have something that, you know, AI is, even how you define it right now is a challenge. You know, generative AI is one thing, but AI, obviously spell check is AI. So it's how to define it and how to advise the profession to be careful about the use of it. So as I said, I'm aware that the Canadian Judicial Council are working on that kind of direction as well. So likely we'll have to do something, probably have to change our rules and put something in the rules about it.
Yeah. Well, AI is a good sort of concluding thing, forward-looking topic to end on. But is there anything I didn't ask about that you think lawyers in Canada would be interested to know about either the court or your observations of more broadly of the profession currently in the country?
Well, more broadly, I guess this is more from my experience on the Federal Court of Appeal, because I did have an opportunity to see the profession from, you know, from all the way from British Columbia to Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, Labrador. And so I can say that there are a lot of very good, strong lawyers out there. Again, I'm talking from an appellate perspective. There's a lot of very good writing that is happening. And lawyers, my impression too, are lawyers are trying to do the best they can for their clients. And, you know, it is a noble profession. And my experience from going across the country is that we have a lot of very good, very honorable lawyers in the profession. So, and that's important because we need a good, strong, independent bar as much as we need a good, strong, independent judiciary. And so I was almost relieved to see that, you know, it's not just lawyers wanting to make money and that are in business. They're still understanding their role and doing volunteer work and other things to ensure that the traditions of the profession are continued, and that they do speak independently and sometimes protect judicial independence through their words. So that's, yeah, those are some of my observations.
Well, that's a great way to conclude. Thank you so much, Chief Justice Rivelin, for speaking with me today. And hopefully we'll continue to hear from you about your court and through your written decisions as well.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Tim. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you for tuning in to CL Talk. You can listen to the latest episodes on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, and all major listening channels. Just search for CL Talk.